Welcome to Breaking Down Patriarchy. I'm Amy McPhee, all the best. During season 3 of this podcast, we aired an episode on the history of Afghanistan with Dr. Bahar Jalali. I learned so much during my research for that episode, so if you haven't heard it yet, you may want to cue it up after this one. Dr. Jalali talked about long periods of thriving, prosperity, and advancement in Afghanistan. She talked about international meddling that destabilized her country over and over again. She talked about the tensions between conservative religion and progressive values, and between diverse rural tribal cultures and urban centers. And above all, she talked about the dramatic back and forth of women's civil rights, sometimes granted and sometimes violently taken away. Today, I am so excited to zoom in on one woman's story through the book Defiant Dreams, The Journey of an Afghan Girl Who Risked Everything for Education, by Sola Mahfouz and Malena Kapoor. And I'm thrilled to welcome to the podcast the authors of this book. Welcome, Sola and Malena.
Thank you for having us.
I'm so excited to jump into the discussion. First, as I always do in the episodes, I'll just read your kind of official biographies, and then I'll let you tell your personal stories after that. Sola Mahfouz was born in Afghanistan and immigrated to the United States in 2016 to attend college. She is currently a quantum computing researcher at Tufts University Quantum Information Group. In her free time, she is focusing on reading and studying different styles of fiction, as well as writing about the rugged homeland she's left behind. She lives in Boston. Malena Kapoor is a writer from Redwood City, California. She previously served as a fellow at PEN America, where she advocated for international human rights, press freedom, and election integrity. Malena served on the management team of a refugee resettlement organization and was the producer of In Deep, a nationally syndicated public affairs radio broadcast program. She's received national awards for her poetry, personal essays, and short stories. And Malena will graduate from Stanford University in 2025. Congratulations to both of you on amazing work. Malena, I'll just throw out that my husband and I are both Stanford grads. Graduate school, and two of our kids were born at Sequoia Hospital in Redwood City.
Oh, wow. I was born there, too.
Oh, my gosh. So cool. Okay, we'll have to chat after. So excited to have you both here. And I'm wondering if you could just maybe take turns telling us a little bit more about your personal life, where you're from, and then what brought you together to produce this book.
Yeah, so, you know, I was born in Afghanistan, 1996, first time Taliban in power. So there was no school for girls, but I was a kid then. But then 2001, Taliban were ousted by the U.S. and its allies, and school reopened, and I started going to school. But, you know, Afghanistan went through such a dark time, the civil war, and then the Taliban time, you know, the school were not an intellectually thriving environment. But that too come to an abrupt end in 2006. When I was 11 years old, a group of men came to our door and threatened my family if I continued going to school. And so that was the end of my formal education. And from that day on, the restriction on my life continued to increase. And I had to leave home only a couple times a year. And whenever I did, I had to wear the suffocating burqa, which covered me from head to toe. But meanwhile, my brothers were going to school and they were thriving academically. And I began to feel jealous of their life. They seemed to have this purpose that they were advancing every day. And my life, meanwhile, was like dancing to the rhythm of outside world. And the situation, political situation, was getting worse and worse. Suicide bombing, exploding, fighting, starring. And so I asked and searched for the meaning of my life. And I was 14 and I thought about my grandfather, who was self-taught, and said, if you know English, it's like opening a window to the world. And I felt the world outside me was dark and I needed that light to come in. And we have in Pashto, we have saying like light equals to education. So this is, they're both like synonymous. So I started learning English and then I went on to study math and physics using Khan Academy. And in 3 years, I was able to go to, from not, you know, at that time, I did not even know how to add and subtract when I started, and to study college with calculus and physics and all, because I wanted to understand the world. And so Defiant Dreams is my story in Afghanistan and how I overcame all of the challenges to be here in the U.S. as a quantum computer and researcher.
And my background is
You know, I was first introduced to Sola in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. At that time, I had just graduated from high school and I was taking a gap year before starting at Stanford. And I knew very clearly that these issues around education and women's rights were really important to me. And Sola and I really connected immediately on that. And she knew she was looking to tell her story, but she was looking for someone to do that with. And so we initially met over Zoom. You know, we couldn't meet in person, but Sola started telling me these incredible stories from her life, and I started writing them. And over that COVID year, that became the basis for this book, Defiant Dreams. And eventually, you know, Sola and I were able to meet in person and really develop this close friendship that I think came out of the process of writing the book, because someone can't tell you the stories from their life just in a vacuum, right? It has to be a give and take. And we really formed our relationship, I think, based on our long conversations, based on our very similar cultural backgrounds, and then based on our shared values and goals and dreams for what came next. And initially, this book was supposed to be Sola's life story of, you know, how she was secretly educating herself in Afghanistan, the danger she faced in trying to escape, but how she made it to the United States. But during the process of us writing, the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021, and then the Taliban subsequently took over the country again. And I think the book and our partnership really feels much more urgent today, because now there are millions of girls in Afghanistan who are living Sola's story, who are forced to stay within the walls of their home and are unable to access education or even go out without a man accompanying them. And so that really, I think, has become the focus of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, this is really incredible. And I got chills and tears in my eyes already, Sola, with you telling your story. And one thing that really struck me is, like when you said learning on Khan Academy, like so many people across the world, and just the incredible, I guess, democratization that has happened because of internet access, that people can have access to education even if they can't go to a schoolroom. So that brings up like a lot of questions, one of which is, how did you have internet access? Did your family have a computer? And maybe more broadly, my question would be to you, if you can tell us some more details about what that self-education process was like for you.
Yeah, so first of all, you know, there were not a lot of learning materials. I started learning English and I would be watching for hours and hours BBC and CNN, and I would understand a word or two. But that was like, it just felt like it was in the dark and there was just like flashes of light once in a while. But I still like kept doing it. And then, yes, at that time we had internet, but it was like slow dial-up connection. Like it would sometimes take an hour like just to like to connect. But I would always compare myself to my grandfather. I was like, if he could do it at that time, you know, when he only had a radio or like a dictionary, I can do it now. And then, you know, after 2 years of learning English, I wanted to study something more, because I was watching all the time news and on TV there was war outside, and I didn't want to be all the time surrounded by war. And my brother was going to Pakistan and I asked him, just bring me anything that's in English. And so he brought me this Time magazine and I found out about Khan Academy, and immediately I felt like this is what I needed. And I did have a laptop because my sister is living in England, so she sent me one. And so I opened up Khan Academy and I saw, you know, the beauty of like the first advertisement for algebra. And I felt like this was too hard for me, because I overheard conversation from my brothers and cousins when they talk about, you know, this one line equation, it takes like pages of proofs. And then at the end, you just get one answer. And I was so intrigued by it, of how can that be? But I was like, you know, this is not for me. I just don't know anything. And so I was disappointed. And then I asked my brother, you know, what comes after addition and subtraction? And so he told me fractions. And when I searched, I found fraction. And I also learned that, oh, I actually don't really know my addition and subtraction really well. And so I went back to study that. And I was just obsessed with it, because it was just like entering a different space of my mind. And it just like building something in my head, you know, it just felt really freeing and empowering. And I think even though it was really hard, but just that feeling of freedom that I'm able to do something by myself just kept me going.
I think too, something important for us to your earlier question, to represent in the book was this fact that there is a plurality of experiences in Afghanistan, right? So Sola was fortunate to come from a family that had access to the internet, even if it was this incredibly slow dial-up connection that was something we experienced decades ago in the United States. But still, you know, her family had enough money where she could have access to a laptop. But I think the point remains that even someone with a few opportunities, not everyone in Afghanistan had, even given that, she still faced so many obstacles. You know, the fact that even though she had that internet connection, when she would go on Khan Academy, she would have to log on in the middle of the night because that was the only time that she wasn't required to cook and clean as a girl in her household. She would have to download these videos one by one, incredibly slowly. And then there were these mental blocks, too, that we've talked about a lot. This idea that, you know, in Afghanistan, most girls are raised to believe or just conditioned by the environment around them to believe that somehow girls are not built to gain an education. And so Sola has told stories about how she would study for hours, you know, at night, and then she would get a headache, like we all do if we're looking at a screen or trying to work on something. But she would see that initially as proof that, oh, girls are not meant to study. You know, I'm getting sick because I'm a girl and I'm studying. And there were just so many of those kinds of things to overcome. But I think the fact that she continued to seek out that education really proved how essential it was to her at that time.
Wow. Yeah, that's really powerful. I'm so glad you talked about that too, like the plurality of experiences, because even just my very limited experience, I've been working with Afghan families of refugee backgrounds where I live. I now know four families, and all of them are roughly the same age, but they're from various places in Afghanistan and extremely different circumstances. A couple of the women don't read in their native language. They speak Pashto and they don't read and can't like sign their names. But then other women, again, of the same generation, were teachers in Afghanistan. And so I know not to reduce people to a single story and like to reduce people to what you see in the news. But even for me, I was like, oh, like it shouldn't have been surprising, but it was. And so I'm just so glad to have you highlighting like the different experiences that people have and how, I mean, I know there's even like microcultures within families everywhere in the world, right? About how you approach education and gendered expectations and stuff. So interesting. Would you be able to tell us a little bit too about like your parents' experience? What were your mother's opportunities like in her life?
Yeah, so, you know, my mom was born at the time when Afghanistan was making a new identity for itself. It was modernizing, schools were opening, universities were opening, and, you know, Kabul universities, there was international exchange programs. And, you know, she tells me story, it feels like it's somewhere from a fairy tale. Like when she was telling me, I was not able to put this, you know, the Afghanistan that I knew, to put her stories in the Afghanistan that I knew. And so, you know, she went to school and her whole life was all about like, okay, what's next? What's like, what university? What should I study? And all of that. And, you know, it's also really important a lot of the time, you know, for right now, it's like the Afghan identity, especially women's identity, is shrouded by the burqa. But it wasn't like that all the time. You know, she tells me stories of how, in addition to education, there was like this obsession with fashion. And she was, you know, from Kandahar, she went to Kabul University. And she told me this one story of her friend that one day, you know, she wanted to do a new hairstyle and like to have a volume. And it was winter, Kabul winter. And, you know, she turned on a fan and then she got sick because it was cold and she missed lecture for a few days. And so like that was, you know, what's happening. But of course, there was also, you know, again, as you mentioned in the beginning, there was this forces that, you know, wanted to go back to the old ways. And also because, you know, the time of the Cold War and like against the Soviets, there was this international funding for these groups. And so there was always this back and forth and there was threats. But for some time, Afghanistan was on its way to become a place where women and men were equal. And there was like, you know, a new nation state was building.
Yeah, I would add that Defiant Dreams is obviously Sola's story, but we made a conscious choice to actually start with the story of Sola's mother about her experiences as a student at Kabul University, as then a professor, you know, taking the bus by herself, going to concerts with her friends. Because one, it really shines a light on how different Afghanistan was and maybe could have been. But also, I think it brought out a very central theme in the book, which is this idea of mothers and daughters, and the idea that in Afghanistan, there are generations of mothers who have experienced more freedoms than their daughters ever will now. You know, you mentioned those women who were teachers, who worked in big cities, and now their daughters can't even go to school past the sixth grade.
Well, let's talk about that more. Maybe we'll save that kind of for the end of the episode, talking about the situation right now in Afghanistan. But first, let's continue on your life path, Sola, and you can tell us from, you know, this period where you were educating yourself at home, how did you get from there to becoming a quantum information researcher? And knowing that that's the end of the story when you started talking about, like, I need to learn fractions, like going on that journey to where you are is just incredible and so inspiring. So take us through that journey.
Thank you. For me, there was a lot of question in my head, you know, why the world worked the way it is. And also the patriarchy is like how it feels to convince me with the logic that I can't do things just because I'm a woman. And also there's like the meaning of life. And like then that led into more philosophical questions of the existence of not just my life, but also like the world, why the world exists and all of that. And so when I started learning fraction, and then I will start looking at more in philosophy and also cosmology. And I knew that for me to be able to study more of that at a higher level, I have to study math, more math. And so that was really my motivation to do more. And also, again, as I said, it's like it was the feeling of empowerment. And so I was like study for every like 8 hours or something, like every hour that I got, like I would study. And for English, I would like translate vocabularies and then record in my own voice. And so if I was like washing dishes and anything, so every minute of my life, I saw it like, how can I learn? And so, yeah, in like in 2012, that's when I started learning math and science. To 2015, I felt like I wanted to go out. And as my age is also like the societal pressures to get married. And so I also wanted to not get married, just to study. And for that, it was not an easy path. I saw my brother going abroad to study, but I didn't have a high school diploma or anything like that. And so I will first like take the English exam and also like something to prove my high school equivalency. And so I went to a local education ministry, but they denied to give me an exam where I can prove myself. So that was an end. And then I looked up and say, oh, if there's any other international exam that I can take. And I found out about the GED. And again, I didn't have the books to prepare. And so I asked my sister who lived in England to send me something. And then she did send me the preparation books. It took a few months, but then it arrived. And so I spent a few months on that. And then finally, to take the exam, when I searched, there was no exam in Afghanistan. And there was also no exam in Pakistan. But still, like, I really didn't want to give up hope, because the hope was the only thing that sustained me. And so I didn't want to lose that. And so I was like, okay, if I can't do this, let me just focus on the English exam. Just let's take that and see what happens. So I started preparing for that. And so while I knew that my reading skills and my listening skills were good, I did not know about my spoken English, because I never practiced that. So I looked online, and then I found this website, conversationexchange.com. So it's a website that works that you put your native language and then you put the other language you want to learn. And so I got connected to this American girl in the US. And so we start talking, and then she was like, how do you know all of those things? And like, I think you're at the level that you should come to the US and like study in the university. And then she told me about the SAT, that in order for you to come to the US, apply to the universities in the US, you should take the SAT. And that's when I found out about it. And immediately I started looking at it. And again, it was not available in Afghanistan. It was only available in Pakistan. And I made the decision that I'm going to take it. And it was a very hard and arduous journey. But again, I was like kept at focus on like what will come at the other end of it.
Yeah, I remember when I heard this story for the first time of how Sola really had to fight to get out. Once she already had her education, you know, she just needed then a pathway out. I was amazed. And then when we were writing these chapters, I remember I would call her all the time and say, I just can't understand, you know, how did you go from at 16 not being able to add and subtract to at 19 doing college level calculus and physics and reading philosophy? I think it's something that's hard to understand from our position in the United States. And so I would call her over and over and she would try to explain. And I think what I finally came to understand is that in many respects, learning is such a natural part of growing up here, of course. But for girls in Afghanistan, especially girls growing up in Kandahar, where Sola grew up, you know, your life becomes defined first by whose daughter you are and then by whose wife you are. And in Kandahar, a sign of your daughter's beauty or value was how young you could get her married. It was common for girls to be married at 14, 16, 18 is considered late. And so that was the life that she saw for herself. And in light of that, I think the motivation to just keep learning and keep going became something that maybe you can never even find in a place like the United States. And then there were just the incredible obstacles. You know, as she mentioned, she tried to take so many exams. She tried to order, you know, have her sister send her prep books for an exam that didn't even exist. And Kandahar didn't even have a mail system at that time. So, you know, the books had to come from one person to the next and they took months to arrive. And then there was that SAT journey where Sola crossed into Pakistan. The Afghan-Pakistan border is one of the most dangerous borders in the world. It's a border where people are regularly beaten with electric cables, where men and women have to cross separately, where you have to take multiple vehicles just to get across. And that was the journey she had to take, you know, just to sit in an exam room and hope she could get a score high enough to apply to universities.
That's unbelievable. This is blowing my mind. I'm just thinking also with these conversations, I can imagine it as you're writing the chapters and going like, wait, how is that even humanly possible? And Sola's like, I don't know. I'm just really, really smart and like really, really dedicated. That I actually don't even know how that's humanly possible to make that much progress in that short of a time, even if you had every advantage.
Yeah.
But to think of all the disadvantages, so it's just really incredible and really incredible. Okay, I want to know more about the journey. So then you took the SAT in Pakistan, is that right? And then how did you get to the U.S.? What kind of visa and how did you get it? Where did you go to school? How did you end up at Tufts? Tell us everything.
Yeah, so I took the SAT and I scored high enough to apply to universities, and that's what I did. And then the next step was to apply to a student visa to come to the U.S. as a student. And so I applied for an appointment, and with my mother, I flew to Kabul. And this was the first time she was also seeing Kabul after leaving it in the civil war. And so I went to the U.S. embassy in Kabul, and in 1 minute, my visa was denied. And the officer just told me, like, first, initially, he just said, we can't give you a visa. And when I asked for an explanation, he said, well, I don't think you're going there to study. You're just going there to immigrate. And this was the first time I also saw how the world sees Afghan, just this desperate people who just want to immigrate and just go there to, I don't know, work or whatever. And I just felt like I was falling into an abyss, because whatever that was in my hands, I did. But this thing was not in my hand. And I was like crying and asking, why are you denying my visa? And I also knew that I can't just go back and resume a normal life, because I know I can do this thing. You know, I passed the exam, everything, and I got accepted to university. How can I just go back? You know, that was the end of the student visa. But my friend Emily, she was also very furious, because over the 20 years, the U.S. had like, oh, we are helping Afghan women, all those things. And it's also this image of, here I am, I studied, you know, I did everything, and that, I don't know, in the context of what was said, should be able to come and study, but yet it was denied. Later, I was talking to some professors here in the U.S., and they all come together. And, you know, I was able to get a humanitarian parole visa, which is kind of one-way visa. And so that's how I, after 1 month after my visa was denied, I came, and I did not know when I will be able to go back. And of course, it changed how I was initially coming. And it's also my perception of the world. And everything that I felt like I knew about the world just broke down. And I had to like rethink about the world and how it works. And yeah, so I came to the US and I started university at Arizona State University. And I was studying physics. Then I came to Tufts University because of my interest in understanding the world and also philosophical questions about the world and quantum information. Quantum computing really is a field that's in the intersection of all of that. Physics, philosophy, and also like trying to understand the world from like entering to atom and then see how the whole world emerges out of it. And it's been 4 years since I'm at Tufts.
I was going to add as well, I think that story, you know, there's that period where Sola was rejected, the visa officer rejected her. And then fortunately, she was in touch with people here who were able to rally and help her to get that humanitarian parole visa. But that state of limbo we write about a lot in the book, just how devastating that was. And also because, as Sola touched on, you know, she took a massive risk as well in educating herself, not just because, you know, people might have found out or because there was a danger inherent in going to school, but also because the knowledge she was exposing herself to and the world she was exposing herself to outside of Kandahar, Afghanistan, meant that it was almost impossible then for her to ever exist in the society that she had grown up in. And in the book, we write a lot about tensions around this that involved Sola's mother, because on one hand, she was a woman who deeply valued education, who saw it transform her life and wanted that for her daughters. But she also realized that if she encouraged her daughters to seek that out in a place where that was not rewarded and where it was actually something that might prevent them from living a safe and secure life, there was also danger in that. And so her mother wrestled with a lot of that. On one hand, you know, not wanting her to do some things, but on other hands, flying with her to Kabul to try and find that way out. And then now, and I know we're going to talk about the future later too, but I think we write in the book about how Sola then had to grapple with that when staying in touch with family members who are now in Afghanistan, young family members, where you want to gift them what English has to offer. You want to send them books and articles and poetry, but at the same time, you realize that if they start to vocalize the thoughts and ideas that are in those texts or start to dream of a life outside of the country, then that can be a real danger.
Yeah, a physical danger, right? But then, yeah, I can only imagine how excruciating that would be to feel that tension of like, once you open that up and introduce those ideas, but then if they don't have access to the path to be able to pursue it, it's almost like setting you up for a life of frustration and just sorrow at something that you can't have. That would be so hard. Okay, I have so many questions, but everyone just needs to buy the book and read it and get all these questions answered. But one thing I wanted to ask too is like, you going to, you know, Arizona and then to Massachusetts, two extremely different places from each other and both so different from Afghanistan. Did you go by yourself? Did you arrive in Arizona all by yourself or did you have anyone with you?
Yeah, so initially I arrived in Chicago and then that's where Emily, my friend, was, and she picked me up. And after a few months of like me orienting myself in this new country, she flew actually with me initially to Arizona State University as well for a few days. And then, yeah, I was able to take a tour myself.
Incredible. Even that, like, oh, that's hard for anybody. Again, like college freshman, that is so hard to go somewhere new. Yeah, this is just amazing. And now you're at Tufts doing quantum physics and philosophy, and that's just incredible. I want to maybe broaden the conversation a little bit and talk about how your experiences shed light on the broader issues of women's rights and education access. I have specific questions and thoughts, but I'd love you to just answer that question.
Yeah, I think the first thing, Julie, is that a lot of the time, there's not that strong feeling like how much we value education. And I've seen it with myself and now with so many like family members. I say like, you know, if education is given, it's taken for granted. When it's taken away, it becomes a secret thing, and then getting it becomes the ultimate defiance. And I think just like knowing that, and also when we feel that, then that will make us more aware of, you know, what Afghan women are going through. And a lot of the time also is the thing like, oh, it's the culture or things like that. But that's not true. You know, look, my mother back in 1960s, that was so different. And also like what's happening right now is not an Afghan culture. And also it's not like the women just silently accept this thing. Their blood is boiling with anger. And if we become aware of the pain there, then all of us would like look for solution. And also say that, you know, the amount of energy Taliban put out every day in suppressing women, if you even like put a fraction of it in helping back, we will see a very, very different result.
And I also think a real goal with the book was to humanize the situation, because it's easy to read in a newspaper article, you know, millions of girls denied education, but it's hard to actually understand what that means. And so our hope with this book is that, you know, when readers understand the history of Afghanistan through Sola's parents and grandparents, and when they feel like they're on the journey with her, you know, to try and find that education and try and get out and understand the incredible obstacles she had to overcome, and then multiply that by, you know, 2 million, because that's how many other girls are stuck in similar situations today. And there have been even more in the past. Hopefully that allows people to gain a deeper understanding of the issue. I think it was certainly true for me. You know, I, growing up in the United States, I think I had an understanding that, you know, these were serious issues in other parts of the world. But by first hearing Sola's story and then getting to know her really personally, I think it changed my conception of just how dramatic these human rights violations are, and then what they mean on an individual level, and then, you know, how much progress can come if we lift those restrictions even on one girl.
Yeah, for sure. That's what I was thinking too, is just like, I just got this sense of like the potential energy in each individual human being, and like your potential, Sola, that you were able to just like blast out, like once you were given an avenue for it, was like just this incredible raw intellectual potential, and that now it has an avenue, you can reach your full human potential. And just the incredible like tragedy for each individual who isn't allowed to do that, and then the loss that the entire world experiences by not allowing all of these humans to flourish and make their contributions. Like, we can make such progress if we just, like you said, remove the restrictions so that each individual, and then multiplied out, can reach their potential. So what changes are necessary to address the education disparities for women and girls? Because this is obviously a huge problem in Afghanistan, but also in other countries as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, what Sola's story really highlights is first the fact that there are really profound institutional barriers that prevent women, you know, specifically in Afghanistan, but then across the world, from accessing education. So that looks like the visa officer, you know, who can reject an application in 1 minute, even though that woman has been studying for years. But that also means a lack of access to physical schools or teachers. And so, you know, this is a question that Sola and I have gotten often as we've traveled and talked about the book and her story, and it's a very difficult one to answer. But I think what her story demonstrates most clearly is that power of technology, and we think it's important to invest in solutions for girls who can access the internet, and in the specific case of Afghanistan, you know, build solutions with these Afghan women in mind. For example, right now, there are some initiatives out of the State Department to bring online learning to Afghan girls, but those are insufficient because they're partnerships with private companies. And Sola knows from experience that you can't even download videos from those companies in Afghanistan because the internet simply isn't strong enough, or maybe there's not language support, or maybe these programs, some of them are job training programs, but how will that work if there's no infrastructure in Afghanistan for women to get a job? And so my perspective is it's a combination of, you know, real private sector investment in building these technological solutions. And then there was a responsibility for all of us to continue to keep the stories of these women in Afghanistan in the headlines so that there's then pressure on governments and these bigger institutions to then help forge pathways out for these girls.
Yeah, and it's not just like pathways out. Also, like, yeah, even when they're there, you know, there is, because now, again, like Melina said, there's a lot of talk just like, oh, let's just kind of turn away from the problem. But if we just like really build something real, and it's not just like, oh, let's help those poor women. It shouldn't be like that. Like Afghans also, something is, we have so much pride. And in Pashto, we have a saying, like, if you're giving some a charity, don't give it as a charity. It shouldn't be something like that. And a lot of the programs are like that. So I think one of the reason I was able to use Khan Academy and loved it so much, it was not a charity. It was something like, immediately you went there, you felt like this feeling of empowerment. And it needs to be something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what can individuals do, people who are listening to this or watching this right now, how can we help support global efforts to improve education for women?
I think the most important thing for individuals is just, as I said, to continue to tell these stories, because ultimately what we've seen in Afghanistan is actually, initially, there was a lot of conversation when the Taliban took over of this, maybe Taliban 2.0, maybe they're different, maybe they want international recognition. And that was the story for as long as Afghanistan was in the headlines. And as soon as it faded away, that's when the Taliban began this systematic program to strip away the core freedoms of women. That's when they banned school for girls. That's when they prevented women from working. And that's continued over the last several years, where basically there are new edicts every week or every other week that just continue to strip away freedoms from women. And so, speaking from my own experience growing up in the United States, you know, I think there is great power in movements that seek to bring these stories to the forefront. I remember when I was young, learning about issues of girls' education through stories of women like Malala Yousafzai. And then, you know, that grew into a massive movement among students, but also among so many people in the Western world. I'm on a college campus right now. And of course, college campuses were so integral to fights against injustices like apartheid. And now there are people at the UN who are calling what's happening in Afghanistan gender apartheid, right? This is something that exists at that level. And I think continuing to talk about it and to feel angry about what's happening and to understand the stories of individual women and girls, that's the most important thing that we all can do on an individual level.
Mm. Do you think, partly, I'm just thinking about this, like, I struggle sometimes because I do feel so much anger and grief about what's happening. And I sometimes don't know where to put it, like what to do with it in a positive way. Mm. I don't struggle to feel empathy, but I do sometimes, I feel lots of empathy and I'm educated about the issues. But then sometimes I'm like, I mean, writing to President Biden or writing to a senator or something, and then elevating women's voices on the platforms that I do have, are things that I've thought of to do, sometimes donating to charities, but sometimes it just feels, it is a struggle. But I like what you're saying, to like, if everybody does, if everybody puts that public pressure on, then maybe it is something that our elected officials realize, like, okay, our constituents do feel strongly about this, so that they make it a priority and it doesn't just fall off of their agendas once it's out of the, you know, once the New York Times isn't talking about it anymore, then they can forget. Is that what I'm kind of hearing you say?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also think, you know, I really identify with that. You know, sometimes you just feel overwhelmed with grief or anger. But like you said, it's hard to place what to actually do with that. At least for me, I feel like that can often come from these sweeping reports that will say, you know, millions of girls denied education, or just these kind of faceless pronouncements of how bad things are in the country. I think what makes room for more hope, or hopefully gives people a place to put that energy, is when we start to hear more individual stories. And when, instead of in the letters, you know, referencing statistics, which of course are powerful in their own way, we also, you know, have access to stories of many, many more women like Sola. And we hear from, you know, women and their reactions to the recent Taliban announcement that stoning will now be a punishment against women, you know, so that there's some way for us to identify with the people who are going through this. And then also, hopefully, when communicating these stories to elected officials or to others, there's again that deeply emotional individual connection.
Yeah, and also, as Melina said, it's when you talk to people, like I'm in touch, there's times that they give me more hope than, you know, because there's so much there. They're still like, they want to learn. If you just even like, let's say I tell them, oh, I'm going to like talk to you for an hour in English, they're so happy. And then they just like for the whole week, they look out to this hour. And I was like that too once, you know, when I was there, like my cousin would tell me, I would ask him, like, practice English with me. And so I think, you know, those small things that might not change life on a bigger scale, but just like add so much meaning to life. And also, I think it's not just you're helping the girls there, they're helping you back, because there's so much wisdom in them. And like in Afghanistan, I say it's just like, first of all, it's like a country that has been ancient civilization. And there's so much, even 15-year-old, they had so much depth in what they say. And it's not just like a one-way thing that you teach. They will teach you about life, and as you teach them in English. And so, yeah, I think just thinking in that way, well, also they're not just like this all suppressed, oppressed. You know, there's so much in there that they can offer to an individual and also the world.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something that people can do wherever we live, is to look at like, doing local volunteering. Like I said, I worked with these Afghan families, and that's just, as you say, enriched my life and my family's life so much. Also, just having relationships and like laughing with kids and being reminded like, oh yeah, kids everywhere are the same. Like, they're funny and they're silly. And yes, I've learned so much too about slowing down and like enjoying people's company, because Americans are so like rush, 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 rush. And like, we're like, and have a long meal that at first stressed me out. And I was like, oh, this is so much better. Like, we need to adopt this way into our family anyway. So I'm wondering, as you were writing the book, as you first conceived of it and then were writing and publishing, what were your goals in specifically writing this book? And then what has your experience been as you're talking to people who've read it and you're, you know, doing book promotion? What is the impact that it's having?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one, the main goal, as we talked about, was this idea of shining light on the situation facing women in Afghanistan through the very personal experiences that Sola has been through. I think a second goal for both of us was, how can we paint a picture of Afghanistan that hasn't been painted before? Because I think, especially in the United States, you know, we have this idea of Afghanistan maybe in a Cold War context, Afghanistan definitely post 9/11. But what we lack is this very detailed picture of life there that's colored by the individual experiences. And so, you know, people who live there. So that meant, yes, writing about Sola's journey to take the SAT and logging onto Khan Academy for the first time. But it also means that one of the earliest stories in the book is about how Sola's father, when she was growing up, loved to dance, and how that was so different from the cultural expectations for men at the time. We have chapters at the end of the book that talk about how, even when bombs are exploding, you know, how Afghans find humor in those moments, and what is the very unique way that people laugh in Afghanistan. And that's certainly something that we encountered, Sola and I, when we were in this process of writing. And, you know, Sola would tell a joke and I would be like, that's not funny, but it's, you know, something that is symbolic of the culture that she comes from, you know, and that's something we wanted to paint. We wanted to show that Sola is this driven girl, you know, hungering for an education, but that also sometimes she would just turn on Bollywood songs in the kitchen when she was cleaning, or the fact that she, you know, loved to bike, but she could only ride her bike within the walls of her compound in Afghanistan. But when she landed in the United States, one of the first things she did was go for a bike ride, you know, where she couldn't see where she started and she didn't know where she would end. You know, those are really beautiful moments. And I think they're moments that we could all relate to no matter where we come from. And it was important to us to share that side of Afghanistan too. And then in terms of the reception that we've had as we've traveled and talked about this book and Sola's story, I think it's been incredibly moving to see because, you know, in many respects, even though we're co-authors, so there was the two of us, but writing a book can be a very solitary experience and you know what you want to convey to the world, but you don't ultimately know how they're going to interpret it. But I think what we've seen is the book has really touched people who have lived through similar experiences in Afghanistan, in other countries in the Middle East, and who deeply identify with the story in that way. But it's also touched people who maybe haven't thought about Afghanistan in years or even since the time of 9/11, who weren't even aware of what was happening to women, you know, soccer coaches who have bought the book for their entire graduating class of girls, people who have reached out talking about how they never followed global affairs or the news, but this really touched a chord in them. And I think that's been so rewarding and so important because it's so important to spread these kinds of stories that just very naturally touch people if there's a platform to get them out to the world.
Sola, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that in terms of like how it felt to you to put your life story in a book and have lots and lots of people read it?
Yeah, like for me, the important thing really was for me to, again, you know, it's like Afghanistan is seen mostly through a journalistic view and I saw so much complexity in it. In one moment, we would be like learning dance for a cousin wedding and then second moment, bomb exploding and my aunt coming to the room, opening the windows for that, like that it doesn't like just like break because of the pressure and we would still feel like as something normal, like we still continue, okay, the window is open, we're safe, we continued our dancing. And so I really want this, you know, dance between life and death always intertwined in Afghanistan and how we still want to make the best out of it. And it's not that we don't understand that, it's just we understand so well that, you know, we are still doing that. So I think just like, it's not just always in the news, you just like smoke rises and that's all you know about Afghanistan. There's so much more. So that's one was the reason I was so passionate to tell my story. And another thing I really think is like sometimes I really wanted to understand was like why are women all over the world, there are restrictions. You come to the US, you're in Afghanistan, and I try to understand, is there something wrong with women? Like, what is it? And so then I finally come to understand, you know, this bigger thing of patriarchy and how that has been imprisoning women in different ways. And I just seeing like this thread of women's oppression being connected to patriarchy, whether it's here in Afghanistan or in other places in the world, and in some places less extreme. In Afghanistan, it's the most, the extremest of extreme version of it. And I think also just like trying to look at this world in that context, I think it helps that, yeah, it's just like if we help Afghan women now, it's like we are helping ourselves as well because we are all ensnared by this one thing.
Yes, thank you. Yes, yes. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's something that I feel really strongly. And I'm sure you know the quote from Fannie Lou Hamer, who was a civil rights activist, nobody's free until everybody's free. And that's something that really resonates with me. I'm dealing with patriarchy in my own faith context and my own community and the ways that it's impacted me. But I felt like this incredible sense of sisterhood with women all over the world as I've done this podcast and including today hearing you. And like, I can't think of a more inspiring story about breaking down patriarchy, right? Like breaking down the unjust barriers that hold women back and then creating something brave and new and beautiful and just like the defiant act of fulfilling your human potential. And yeah, I've been so inspired by your story. So grateful. I can't recommend the book highly enough. It's called, again, Defiant Dreams, The Journey of an Afghan Girl Who Risked Everything for Education by Sola Mahfouz and Malena Kapoor. So Sola and Malena, thank you again for being here. This was just an honor to have you.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up today's episode. Before I go, I want to thank Sam Rose Preminger for our editing and production and Aubrey Iyer for our social media. And as always, I want to thank you listeners for being here. Make sure to check out our YouTube channel, Breaking Down Patriarchy, which features short, super entertaining videos that were created specifically to be able to share with friends and family members. Huge thanks to Ralph Blair and Aubrey Iyer for their genius work on that series. And if you want to show your appreciation for this excellent ad-free content, the most helpful thing you can do is to forward this episode to your friends and family and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. These reviews really do help people find the podcast, and the more people listen, the greater the impact of this grassroots movement to break down the patriarchal structures in our institutions and our relationships and build egalitarian structures in their place. Thanks again for joining me, and make sure to tune in next time for another fascinating episode on Breaking Down Patriarchy.